Now, I will tell you, I mentioned this earlier. I noticed it was a little warmer this morning, so I didn't bother to turn the heat up. So I apologize if it's a little bit cool. But I also don't want you guys to fall asleep and get too comfortable. But it's a little brisk, so I decided I'll put my jacket on today. We were, last week, we were talking about fear, and this is a follow-up to last week because there were some things that we just didn't get to, talking about doing it afraid. You know, we looked at how Jesus was willing to do it afraid. We sometimes can lose sight of the fact that Jesus, in his humanity, understood what it was to be afraid. You think, well, how could he be afraid? I mean, you know, he's powerful and he's doing all these miracles and he understands God in an intimate way because he was with God. He gets it. How could he possibly be afraid? But his humanity did not somehow insulate him and prevent him from understanding that there are dangers and there's death and there are consequences and I don't want to face these things, but not my will, your will. And I'm willing to go face these things even though I'm afraid, even though I don't want pain, even though I don't want to deal with these struggles. I don't want to deal with being mocked, being made fun of, being disrespected and spat on. I don't want to go through these things, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to do it even though I have not overcome this fear. I've not overcome this pain. And so much of our walk with God is defined by our willingness not just to do it once we've overcome and we understand it and we're no longer afraid of it, but long before you get to that place where you've overcome the fear, sometimes you have to do it anyway. And what I want to do today is look at another example of this. I want to look at this from another perspective, from another person, because sometimes when we think about fear, when we think about what is it that not only we as individuals are lacking, what is it that we need to do in our own personal walk, but getting back to what we've been talking about the past couple of months about getting back to church and what that means as we slowly start to emerge and figure the coronavirus out, as we slowly start to gather more, as we slowly start to figure out how this thing is going to work, we're going to start coming back and gathering more and doing more things as a church. We're going to start worshiping together a little bit more. We're going to start getting more active again. And yet there are certain things about the church that God wants us to really address and deal with, because he doesn't just want us to come back and be the same old church. He didn't want to just, okay, so now we feel good because we can come back and sit around each other. But what needs to be different? And what I want to focus on today in a follow-up to last week is part of what needs to be different is not just us. Yeah, that's true. We all need to be different. We need to grow. But more specifically, what needs to be different is we need to not be cowards. We need to not be afraid of certain things. But how do we get to that place? How do we get to that? It's easy to say, well, you know what? You just need to be brave. You need to do it afraid. You need to feel the fear and do it anyway, right? Do it afraid. That all sounds good, but how do you get to that place? You know, I read this last week. This was a quote from Joyce Myers in her book talking about doing it afraid. Just because you feel fear doesn't mean you can't do it. Do it afraid. But how do we get there? Where does it all start? And what is the ultimate outcome? What is the net result? What do we seek to accomplish? Why is this so important when it comes to our relationship with God? You know, there are certain things that we are afraid of. Everybody's not afraid of the same thing. You know, there are things that I remember, I've talked about this in the past. I remember thinking when my wife was pregnant with my son in particular, I remember thinking, I don't know what to do. It was a little scary. And, you know, it was interesting. The church we were here at the time in Atlanta, there was an awful lot of grandparents and great-grandparents that were looking at me like, oh, boy, you'll be fine. They weren't worried about it one bit. They just kind of looked at me like, whatever, it's a baby. And I'm thinking, it's a baby, yeah, but it's, you know. Well, that was something scary for me. But, you know, there were women in there that they had children and children on top of children on top of children and grandchildren. And there was even one lady who used to be a midwife. So for her, it was like, look, I've had a little practice in this. I've got a little experience with babies, so I'm less fearful than you are. You know, we think about it's going to be that time of year because everybody, even though it's coronavirus and they're telling us to watch how we go about our gatherings with the families over the holidays, we're going to find a way to eat. We're going to find a way to get some sweet potato pie and some turkey and dressing somehow. I don't care who you're sitting with and whether you travel and go visit family. You're going to find a way to sit there. Jimmy's going to be depressed because the Cowboys are going to lose. And I'm going to enjoy it because the Bengals are probably going to lose too. We're both going to be sad together, eating some dressing somewhere, right? Eagles aren't having that great a year. So we're all going to be sitting around wallowing in our sorrows. But we're going to find a way to eat, right? And the thing is, January is going to come along because everybody's going to put on those extra pounds. And some people are going to be intimidated even though they know they have to go to the gym. Even though they know they got to start walking and working out and doing something to work off those pounds. Here's the thing. Some of us, though, we go to the gym all the time. And so for us, it's just Monday. But for others, this is a big step forward. But the process, there's a process to developing courage, to developing the will that says, I'm going to face my fears. But it starts with taking the first step. And I want to look at some of those first steps here. We're going to look at the example of David in 1 Samuel chapter 17. Because we look at the example of David, and sometimes we fast forward to his victory over Goliath, and we so conveniently forget how he got to that place. Starting in verse 26 of chapter 17, 1 Samuel says, David asked the men standing near him, what will be done for the man who kills the Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? They repeated to him what they had been saying and told him, this is what will be done for the man who kills him. When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the wilderness? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle. Now what have I done? Said David. Can I even speak? He then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter, and the men answered him as before. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him. David said to Saul, let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him. We see here something. David was concerned with one thing, where his brothers and all the other men were concerned with something else. David was concerned with the fact that God's people, God's army, it was being mocked. It was being made fun of. It was being laughed at. His heart was actually in the right place. Continuing on, it says, Saul replied, you are not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You are only a young man, and he has been a warrior from his youth. But David said to Saul, and this is very important, your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. Keep in mind, his brother just made fun of the fact that he got a few sheep back home. Like, why don't you go back and, you know, go take care of the sheep, right? Go do something, young brother. Go do something that's not that important, right? He said, your servant's been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord, who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine. Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." Now, we all know what happens, right? They dress him all up in the armor, and he goes out, and he says, "I can't go like this. Give me a few smooth stones." Grabs a sling. He strikes him right underneath his forehead. He goes there. He cuts his head off. He says, "See, I told you," right? And everybody looks, and they're amazed, but there's a victory here. Who is this little young teenager? Who is this little shepherd boy who comes along and did something that all of God's army was afraid to do? But David tells them how he did it. He tells them why he did, but he tells them how. How do I get to this place where I can face this giant, this seemingly insurmountable task? How is it that I can face this thing? Because I took on the small things first. Because I took on the lion and the bear. Who is this giant when I'm out here all alone against a lion and a bear? What we find very often is that when it comes to our faith, it's just like anything else. You build on it. God doesn't say, "Hey, I'm just going to throw you out here and make you face something, this giant task." No, but I want you to build. I want you to work your way towards it. I want you to grow in your faith. I want you to grow in your courage. Sometimes we think, "Well, man, you know, I need to go take on this really powerful thing, this really powerful person. I need to go speak up. I got to go speak truth to power to this important body or institution or this group, and I got to stand up in front of 1,000 people." And sometimes we think, "Wow, that seems like a daunting task. That seems pretty scary." But it's not when you start by being willing to speak truth to power, when you're willing to speak up to those people in your life, to your family, to your friends, to those who are close to you right now. Faith is a spiritual muscle. It's just like anything else. You don't just go into the gym and say, "I'm going to go in here and I'm going to squat because my legs can't handle it. I'm just going to go in here and squat 600 pounds. No. You start by squatting your own body weight, and then you slowly add on. What we see here is that David was thrust into a situation long before the armies of God were being taunted, and long before Goliath, he dealt with those things who were in front of him now. We have to start as a church. Before we can go out and tackle all the issues in the community, we got to start by being willing to have the courage to speak up in this congregation. Being willing to speak up to our own families, our own friends. We work and build it in preparation for bigger tests of faith to come. David, people saw the outcome with Goliath, but he points out to them that this has been building. And not only had it been building because of him defending the sheep, him being willing to go after a sheep that was taken by a lion. But notice how his brothers treated him. And we don't have time to go back through the whole story. But if you go back and you look at when Samuel comes and God says, "Hey, you need to go to the house of Jesse and anoint his son. He is the one who's going to be the king because I'm done with Saul." See, we look and see in this moment, we see the beginnings here. We see this is part of the reason why God was done with Saul. It wasn't because Saul wasn't bigger or stronger. He wasn't a good king as far as his stature and being a fighting man. Saul wasn't willing to take on that which was an offense to God. Saul wasn't willing to speak up against it. Saul not only saw sin, but he eventually succumbed to it, and he became part of the problem when it came to sin. The way that Saul was leading is the reason why none of his men, including David's brothers who were already also in the army, they weren't willing to step up to this Philistine. Yes, it bothered them. Yes, it was a problem for them, but they weren't willing to speak on it. They were following Saul's leadership. That's why God was done with Saul in the first place, because he wouldn't tackle small things. And then when the giant shows up, when the Philistines show up, he wasn't willing to tackle those issues either. We think about the holes, the deficits, the areas in this congregation where we are lacking, the areas that we've known for years. We need to grow. We need to change. We need to repent. We need to do something about this. We need to address this. Think about the areas of your marriage, the areas in your own personal life. Maybe it's your personal health. It could be any number of things. Think about those things, because sometimes we do this where we can see and identify and diagnose, but we're not willing to make those first steps towards dealing with it. And then before you know it, we got a big giant problem. Months and years down the road, we got a big giant problem in the Dover Church of Christ, because nobody was willing to deal with it. Because I wasn't willing to deal with me. I wasn't willing to deal with my family, my wife, my own sinful nature. You know, I'm going to do something I normally don't do, and I'm going to, don't be too long. I'm going to go a little political. It makes sense. Everybody's going to be, well, if you haven't already, people are going to be voting here in a couple days. But we talked about the lions and the bears. We talked about those real life fears, and we looked at David, and part of what I want us to think about is, and the reason why I say I'm going to go a little bit political here is because very often people have opinions about politics. Now, we don't necessarily want to share them out loud. You know, people don't want to get in fights about it. And, you know, it can get really touchy, right? You know, especially on certain topics, it gets really polarizing. I tell you, it's not a day that goes by pretty much. Even in a day like this where it's raining and it's really cold, they'll be out there in the snow. I'll drive down the street here, and I see the people out there at the abortion clinic, Planned Parenthood, and they're out there picketing because that's an issue for them. That is something that every 4 years, you know it's going to come up, right? Roe versus Wade. They're going to talk about it. Just like, you know, people talk about, you know, how polarizing Black Lives Matter is, and everybody gets all bent out of shape because politicians, every 4 years, they show up, and then they want to go into black community, and they want to go into certain pockets and segments of the country, our different cities, and because they want votes. And we've become cynical towards that, right? We've gotten a little bit jaded. We've gotten to the point where we just look at them and think, they're just here for votes. They're just here because it's politically expedient, right? We see all of the unrest. And here's the thing, news to everybody, civil unrest and political unrest is not something that's unique to the United States of America. It goes on all over the place. Why? Because people are different and they disagree. Because there are big issues, and what do they say? You know, people just kind of want to kick the can down the road. They don't really want to deal with it. They just want to get through the next election cycle, or they just want to be able to have what it is that they want. We look at them and we think they don't really care about the people. They don't really care about what matters. They really only care about what's going to keep them in power. They really only care about who's going to vote for them. They say the nice things, and then as soon as they get put in office, they run to their separate corners. And it doesn't matter how many millions of people are out there rioting and yelling and screaming and hollering, we want justice, we want peace, we want these different things. They care enough to keep it quiet and put it down. See, I bring this up because some of us, if we're honest, if we really do some self-analysis, we actually care more about politics than we do about the condition of the church. We're actually willing to go out and picket and stomp and we're willing to phone bank, and we're willing to, you know, put out a sign in our front yard. We're willing to do these things, but when it comes to the actual church, the thing that's supposed to matter to us, because our salvation, because what Christ did for us on the cross should matter more than anything else. That is what we should care about, right? But what ends up happening is we become those politicians. We become the exact same thing that we despise because we're not willing to go out and do what is brave. We're not willing to go out and just tell the truth. Because with truth comes what? Consequences, right? If I tell the truth, if I speak up, if I take a stand, we're afraid that something bad might happen. And as much as we look at Saul and think, how could you have the anointing of God, and how could you see that God was with you, and yet you were still afraid? But that's how it happens. We become comfortable in our salvation. We become comfortable in knowing that God is merciful and God is gracious, and we forget to display that very same mercy and grace. It's like politicians that only focus on, you know, their margin of victory, or they only focus on making sure that they look good, but they're not really interested in what actual governance is really supposed to be about, which is serving the people. What we find here with David is that because of his willingness, when he was just that forgotten shepherd boy out in the field, because of his willingness to protect, because of that willingness that he had to go out and do the brave things then, he was then willing to do it later on in life. What we're going to see here as we continue is that there's more to the story of courage and bravery and doing it afraid than just going out and slaying giants. Sometimes it's being willing to go against the grain and do what is unconventional. 2 Samuel chapter 9 tells a very interesting story. I'm going to read through the entire chapter, and then we'll go back through it. It's very important. David asks, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? Now there was a servant of Saul's household named Ziba. They summoned him to appear before David, and the king said to him, are you Ziba? At your service, he replied. The king asked, is there no one still alive from the house of Saul to whom I can show God's kindness? Now, I want to put a pause there, because just to put this in context, when you're the new king and the old king has died or been disposed of, tradition had it, you don't go and look to do anything nice to the old king. You don't look to preserve the old king's legacy and lineage. No, actually what you do is you go out and you seek them out, but you don't seek them out to show them kindness. You seek them out to dispose of them so that nobody would rise up and take you on. Ziba answered the king, there is still a son of Jonathan. He is lame in both feet. Where is he? The king asked. Ziba answered, he is at the house of Machir's son of Melio in Lodabar. So King David had him brought before from Lodabar, from the house of Machir, son of Emil. I'm so glad we had the extra hour last night, because I spent quite a bit of time practicing this. When Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. He said, Mephibosheth, at your service, he replied. Don't be afraid, David said to him, for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table. Mephibosheth bowed down and said, what is your servant that you should notice a dead dog like me? Then the king summoned Ziba, Saul's steward, and said to him, I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul and his family. You and your sons and your servants are to farm the land for him and bring in the crops so that your master's grandson may be provided for. And Mephibosheth, grandson of your master, will always eat at my table. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Let's put a quick pause here. Notice what happens here. He says, not only am I going to show kindness, not only am I going to restore, do something totally unconventional. This is rightfully mine because now I'm the king. But he says, I'm going to take care of Saul's grandson, Jonathan's son, and not only am I going to give him all the land, I'm actually going to give him this servant and all of his servants and his children, and they're going to work for you. So he didn't just say, hey, you know, I'm going to be kind. You know, I'm going to give him some clothes or a nice car, a little parting gift or something. He says, no, I'm actually going to enrich my enemy, the guy who was trying to kill me. He was pursuing me for a decade and a half trying to kill me. I'm going to restore to his grandson. But he says, why was he doing this? He's doing this because of his love for Jonathan. He's doing this because the kindness that Jonathan showed him. Because even though Jonathan's father was against him, Jonathan himself loved David. We're going to come back to that here in a few minutes because this is very important when we talk about doing something afraid. This was a risk for David to do all of this for this man. Continuing on, it says, then Ziba said to the king, your servant will do whatever my lord the king commands his servant to do. So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah, and all the members of Ziba's household were servants of Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem because he always ate at the king's table. He was lame in both feet. Now, it points out twice that he was lame in both feet. If you go back to chapter 4, you can see where the reason why he was lame in both feet. After Saul and Jonathan, after they were killed in battle, naturally, Saul's household, his kingdom, everybody's afraid and they're running. So this guy, Mephibosheth, he was, they believe, roughly 5 years old. And the person who was taking care of him, out of fear and panic, runs away, drops him, breaks both of his legs. Now, you know, we have a certain sensitivity and consciousness about such things in our society today. But back then, if you had broken legs, you walked funny, you couldn't walk straight. There was no kindness shown to you. You were a liability. They would have gotten rid of you. And even if they didn't personally dispose of you, they considered you an afterthought, and whatever happens to you happens. David not only says, I'm going to restore all this, I'm going to do all this for somebody who is handicapped. I'm going to do all this for somebody who society looks at and says, they're not even worthy of this. He wasn't strong. He couldn't fight. When he refers to himself as a dead dog, he's saying, guess what? I knew that you were eventually going to come. I was just counting the days because I knew I was worthless and beneath you, and I knew that everybody had been vanquished in my family, and so I knew it was just a matter of time before you would find me hiding. Why would you do something like this for me? It takes bravery. It takes courage. It takes conviction to say, for David here, I'm not going to build my kingdom on might and strength and dominance and fear. I'm not going to build it on that. I'm going to build it on mercy. I'm going to build it on compassion. I'm going to do things that are not necessarily politically expedient, but no. I'm going to do something just like God would do it. I'm going to have compassion. I'm going to reach out to those who have been victimized. I'm going to seek after, and my political agenda is going to be a king that is merciful. And that's how my greatness will be defined. We see this with this example in Mephibosheth and how he loved him. But when we ask ourselves this question, think about this now. This is all because of how Jonathan treated him. When we think about the way that we treat others, when we think about our relationships and the love we show to others, is somebody willing, you know, I think of myself and I think of my wife and how much we work and we serve, we do different things, and I think of, you know, how we go after people. Would it be said one day when I'm long gone, would somebody walk up to William and Kendall and say, because of how your father or your mother was, I'm going to give something to you. I'm going to protect you. I'm going to love you for your father's name's sake, for your mother's name's sake. The way that we are supposed to build God's church isn't just about numbers. It isn't just about ministries. It isn't just about expediency. We have to care about people. Why? Because God cares about people. David's ability to reflect the heart of God was a result of him constantly overcoming his fear. David wasn't afraid to do this because he had gotten practice in doing this. When he defies the Philistine army, when he takes on Goliath, it wasn't just out of ego and pride. It was out of conviction that says, I'm going to do this because this is for God and this is what's right. It is right to show mercy. Do we have this same conviction? Are we every day, every moment, are we building on this conviction that we have to be fearless, that we have to take on challenges great and small? I talked about it last week. But, you know, it doesn't start with us going out here in Dover and sharing our faith and reaching out to a bunch of people and trying to make disciples of all nations when we're not willing to make disciples in our own homes and our own families and amongst our own friends and coworkers. Are we willing to take on the sheep, fight for the sheep, love the sheep in our own lives? Or are we standing there paralyzed with fear as Satan taunts the church? In order for us to be the church that God wants us to be, we have to be willing to take on those lions and bears in our own life so that we can ultimately take on the challenges that face all the things we see. We see it. We see the toxicity in our community. We see the divisions. We see the negativity. We see where Satan, as it says, has his foothold. But in order for us to be able to take that on, we have to be able to take on those things that are going on in our personal life right now. A few things I want to close with. Because we do, in fact, have to be unique in the way that we approach doing things afraid. First question is, what lion or bear in my life do I need to face today so that I can face the giants that are taunting God's people? We know there are holes and there are issues and there are problems and there are things as a church that we need to develop and grow in. We don't want to just be here and look and think, man, you know, we're really struggling to have, you know, an impact on the youth in our community. We, you know, we're really not involved in dealing with certain populations. We don't, you know, there are people who are disabled. There are people who struggle with abuse and addiction. And we're not reaching them. And we want to reach out to them, and we want to go after them, and we want to be able to have an impact. But are you dealing with those things in your own personal life? Are you willing to step up and deal with those lions and bears that are in your own household that are affecting your own personal life? Before we as a church can be the church that God wants us to be, each individual, you know, we know that the church is not this building. It's not this address. It doesn't just stop here. The church is the people. The church is the people online right now. The church is at all of us collectively, wherever we are. That means if you're sitting in your living room or your bedroom or your kitchen right now and you're watching this, it doesn't matter that you're physically not here in the building. You've got some lions and some bears that you've got to deal with. You've got to confront it. God's calling you to do this because there is going to be a time where there's going to be some real pressure, some very large pressure, and you have to build those faith muscles. You have to be willing to confront those things right now in order for us as a church to be able to collectively deal with those things. What is your namesake worth? Have you invested in shared love in such a way that your children will reap the benefits of it? Now, I throw this in here, and this is not an indictment on any individual, any particular person, me or anybody else. But we have to ask ourselves, what is our name worth? I told you, when we think about politics, everybody's going to go out here and vote on Tuesday. And here's the thing, you know, regardless of who you vote for, you vote for Donald Trump, you vote for Joe Biden. Guess what? When you say the name Donald Trump, it means something. You're going to, even if people keep their face together, you're going to get a reaction. You know, I remember someone was talking about Joe Biden, said he's not as popular. Joe Biden's been in public office for over 40 years. We live in Delaware, in fact. You can't live in Delaware and not know the name Joe Biden very long. He's an institution. His name means something. And it's easy for us to take sides politically or to look at it from a particular point of view and say, I don't like what this person represents, and I don't like that person. I've heard so many people say, honestly, I don't like either one of these candidates. I really don't want to vote for either one. But here's the question we have to ask ourselves. What is your name worth? When somebody says your name, is it somebody who is invested in such a way that they say, you know what? I haven't seen him. I haven't talked to him in a long time. But since you're his friend, since you're his son, since you're his daughter, since you're related to them in some kind of way, I want to trust you. I want to listen to you. I want to be involved with you because I know this man or this woman. That's what it means to be an ambassador of Christ. That for your name's sake, somebody is willing to do something, even if it's just to listen. What is your name worth? When they say your name and somebody remembers, yeah, I know this. I used to work with them. I used to live next to them. I served with them in the Air Force or the Army or the Marines or wherever. You know, I was stationed with them at one point. What is your name worth? Because whatever your name is worth, that's what the church is worth as well. Because collectively, we're a bunch of namesakes in here. People don't look and think, okay, well, you know what? The difference between this group over here and this person, they call themselves the church and they call themselves, you know what? No. This particular group is known by the people who assemble and who collectively come together in it. What is our name worth at the Dover Church of Christ? And what do we want it to be worth? What is our namesake when somebody says the Dover Church of Christ? Do I make the connection with broken people the way that God wants his children to? Am I more interested in what is expedient, or do I care more about justice and mercy? I bring this up because when we think about the church, sometimes we have to remember the church. Our mission, and David shows this very clearly, his mission wasn't just to build this great giant kingdom that was strong and forceful and took on all the armies and always won every battle. David was interested in what God was interested in. David was interested in mercy. He didn't want to just be known as a king. In fact, if you go back and look at it, we don't have time to go through it today. Every time you would see David messing up, it was out of his own insecurity and feeling like he had to build himself up as a general, as a leader of an army, as a king. But every time he was glorifying God, when God was proud of him, when God was getting the victory, it was because he was interested in the things of God, mercy and grace and humility and patience and forgiveness. Are we interested in those things? If we are interested in those things, I contend that the church will reflect that. Our congregation will reflect that. And you know what will happen? Suddenly, people who are broken, people who are handicapped, people who are disabled, people who can't do for themselves, people who have addictions, people who don't look like us and think like us, and people who don't, frankly, maybe have the moral foundation that we have. Suddenly, our church will look like that because that's who Jesus was interested in. Suddenly, we won't look like other churches. We won't look like other groups who call themselves Christians. We will look like the people that Christ went after. Are we more interested in what's expedient and what's going to help the church to look good in other people's eyes and our eyes? Or are we more interested in what God is interested in, which is showing love and compassion for those who are broken? Because after all, let's face it, we're all broken on some level. And finally, am I more concerned about my reputation or the reputation of the church? How can my fearlessness result in honor to God? As we finish out this getting back to church, as we close the book on this, I want us to really consider, how much do we care about the representation of the church? How much does the namesake, the reputation of the Dover Church of Christ really matter to you? How much do you want to do what is right in the eyes of God? Because as we talked about that teamwork, yeah, the team, we always want to win. But I want to make sure that I'm taking care of my responsibility, because the last thing I wanted to be said is not only that we lost, but we lost because of me. We failed to reach. We failed to show the example of Christ. We failed at our mission, the thing that God has called us to do in this community. We failed at it as a church, and it was because I wasn't all that concerned about it. Nobody wants to be the weak link. And frankly, God gives us all the tools and all the resources that all of us can contribute to the winning, to the overcoming, to the service, to the compassion. The way that we can have an impact in this community and be different. Just like we all want a politician who's different. Not just rhetoric, not just talk, not just style. There's a lot of people out there, they voted for Donald Trump. Why? Because he was totally different. He was outside of mainstream. And you know what? Same thing happened with Barack Obama. He was different. He wasn't like everybody else. Here's the thing. People are still looking for something that's different. People are looking for a church. You know, I was out yesterday with the kids. It was interesting how it happened. I'll tell you the story some other time, but just know that it involved Kendall being upset, which is not that uncommon. But Kendall was upset, so we're driving around. We found that there was a group. There's a congregation not too far from here, and they're having trunk or treat outside. And everybody's dressed up in these biblical characters and everything. And it was interesting. It was really cold, and one day I'll tell you about William, why he had on shorts. But the point is, we go and we walk around and they're having this thing. And now here's the thing that's interesting. They were having this youth event. And I asked my son about it because I didn't hear the whole thing. I walked in later. And it was this play they were putting on, Jesus versus Satan, right? And it was a boxing match. And naturally, we know the end of the story. Jesus won. But the point was that as they're doing this, I'm just being honest here. I remember noticing certain things that were incorrect or flaws, and I noticed there were some things that were doctrinally off. There were some things that I know for a fact I wouldn't, and funny, Kendall kind of even looked at me at one point like, is that right? You know. But here's the thing, though. They had the courage to do it. They were willing to do something. See, they're out here on New Street and Queen Street and Kirkwood. They're reaching out to people who are over at Connections every morning. They were willing to be brave enough. They go out, they evangelize, they share their faith. They walk through the neighborhoods. They do what, frankly, so many of us know we should do, but haven't been doing it. And just like Saul in the army, they know that the Philistines are wrong. They know that they shouldn't be defying God. But what are you going to do? When are you going to get the courage? When are you going to start with your own son or daughter or your own mom or dad, your own coworker? When are you going to be willing to say, you know what? Even if it doesn't work out the way I plan it, the Dover Church of Christ will be known for reaching those out in the community. They will be known if for no other reason than people know that I'm a member there. They will be known for being sacrificial. They will be known for having a heart, if for no other reason than they know that I personally am a member there. Are you concerned about the reputation of God's church? And what are you willing to do? What lion or bear are you willing to take on so that the reputation of God's church can be restored? How are we going to follow in the example of David?